some more light rain. Today's high, 49. Some scattered rain in the area now. Very windy. Wind from the southwest at 21, gusting to 35 miles per hour. 43 degrees, Kenosha and Racine. 40 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios Nan Calvert, who joins us once a month and always manages to wrangle up an interesting guest or two to talk about some kind of important topic related to the environment. And today we're going to be talking, first of all, in general, about the notion of citizen science and the way in which ordinary citizens can be a really important part of important scientific research and observation. And in this particular case, we have two citizen scientists who are also very busy environmental activists here in southeastern Wisconsin, Melissa Werner and Jan Carter, who specifically today are going to be talking about the work that they are doing under the auspices of the DNR with bat monitoring. And we've talked about bats before and about their importance to our local ecosystem, but they are still a very much misunderstood creature. So we're going to spend a little time talking about bats and about the exciting work that Jan and Melissa and others are doing as bat monitors here in the area. So we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad you're all here. So, Nan, I thought it would be interesting for us, and we'll maybe circle back to this a little later, but to talk about this notion of citizen science.
Yes.
And that's a phrase that we hear a little bit, but maybe not not all that much. First of all, is this kind of a relatively new sort of idea or notion?
Well, I suppose you could say it's relatively new, but I think that it's gained momentum over the last few years because so many different kinds of projects have been initiated by groups such as the Southeastern Wisconsin Invasive Species Consortium with roadside invasive species, plant species monitoring. You know, when you think about – people often don't think about the Christmas bird count being citizen science, but it is. And that's been going on for a very, very long time. And actually, that's going to be coming up pretty soon. It's almost here. But there are so many other projects out there, water quality monitoring, stream monitoring, all kinds of things. And certainly here in our own community, we have something great going on, bat monitoring. And it's very important, especially now because of white nose syndrome and the devastating effect it's had on our native bat species.
Let's talk to both of our citizen scientists that are in the room, and I suppose Nan, in some respects, probably some of what you do falls under that same category in some ways, right?
What I do is encourage people to do citizen science out there, and I certainly would like to have a lot of that going on out at CNOW KRLT Conservancy as well.
Very good. So Jan Carter, Melissa Warner, let's talk for a moment about the way in which you each have thought of yourselves as citizen scientists. And I know, Melissa, for sure, in terms of the invasive species thing, that's been an important concern of yours. Is that sort of the way in which you first sort of entered the fray as a citizen scientist yourself?
Well, it is indirectly, Greg. Several years ago, possibly as far back as 2008, maybe even 2007, the DNR had a conference out in Merrimack for all kinds of people that were working on citizen science. And Sierra Club paid my way to go because of our work on invasive species. But what captivated me was Dave Reddle, who was the bat biologist for the DNR. And he was pointing out how difficult bats are to study. They're active at night. You can barely see them. You certainly can't hear them. How do you actually study bats to know which kinds are where in the state and how many of them there are? He had this wonderful piece of equipment with him, which I know I'd like to hold it up really close to the microphone so your listeners could see it too. But it consists of this little box that actually hears the bat. It's a detector that hears the bat. And it translates it to a lower frequency so that I, walking around Shoup Park after dark, can hear the bat too. And it puts this lovely little picture, a little sonogram, and it would be a J-shaped one usually for a bat call, on a little screen. It also has a GPS. So when I press save, it collects the picture. It collects the exact location and the exact time. Now, I can't do anything with that data, but when we get home and my sweet spouse, Jay, uploads it to Madison, they can do a lot of information with that picture. And they send us a map, and the map shows us where we walked exactly and little indications of which bats we heard where. So this accumulates a picture over a long period of time. But as far as the interest went, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I was teaching high school at the time at St. Catharines, and we had an environmental club. And I thought, oh, kids, outdoors, at night, technology, they'll love this. So they did. We wrote a grant, and we were able to get one of these detectors. We had to share it with the Urban Ecology Center at first, but after a year, they got their own, and we got this one full-time. And I now have three binders full of maps over a period of time. And so we've been able, or actually the DNR does the picture better than I do, of same places over a summer and then over series of summers. So they really have a good picture now of bat data from Racine.
So you are in the business not only of being a citizen scientist yourself, but of helping to engage a new generation of young people to be citizen scientists as well.
Well, I hope so.
Right.
I hope so.
Very good. Jan Carter, how about you? What are the ways in which, up until now, you have been a citizen scientist? Or have you done something like that, even ahead of your participation in this bat monitoring project?
Well, not much, because I was employed until a year ago when I retired, so my time was somewhat limited. But several years ago, I did go on a bat walk in downtown Racine, and unfortunately, we only found about one bat, which was really surprising to me because I wondered where they were or what was happening. So when this opportunity came up 2 years ago that I should accompany a friend on one of the bat monitoring walks. I thought, oh, that sounds like fun, sounds interesting, and I got hooked on that, and so now I've been going monthly in the summer, going out to Sanders Park and doing my one-hour bat walk.
Can somebody give us kind of the historical overview of when this particular program got started with the DNR and if anything in particular prompted it?
Well, I think Dave Reddell, or Reddell, I'm not sure, started it. And this conference was almost the beginning of this kind of effort.
So that was like a kickoff event, in a sense.
Almost. And the concern, of course, was the detection of the white nose syndrome up in New York, the very earliest awareness of the white nose syndrome that has proved to be so devastating for bats. And he realized, we don't know anything about what we have. How can we determine how this is going to affect us? If we don't have a baseline population, how do we know, how can we say, oh, well, the population's going down? Well, you could sense it, but you didn't know it quantitatively. So I think that was the impetus for the study throughout the state. There are groups like ours all scattered throughout the state.
I just want to emphasize something that Melissa has been saying. When you talk to people about citizen science projects, people that haven't been involved in them as yet, sometimes you'll get this sort of thing that said, oh, but it's just a bunch of people looking at things. How can that possibly have any impact? How do you know it's accurate? Well, the point is that when you're going to participate in a project, whether it's bat monitoring or it's water quality monitoring or it's monitoring for purple loosestrife along our roadways, the organization that is the umbrella organization, whether it's the DNR or CWISC or something else, they have metrics by which they will assess and evaluate your data. And so it really does make an enormous difference, because those of us who participate in this, whether you work at it or you're a volunteer at it, you're out there looking at it on a regularly scheduled basis. And the biologists and the researchers can't necessarily be there every week or every month in Racine looking at this. So it's really a vital connection to what's happening on the ground. And so it really does make an enormous difference in terms of changing populations, moving populations, and all those kinds of things that go into it. So don't think that it really doesn't make any difference, because it does. You can have an enormous impact. And what a great way for families to get their kids involved in science, in a real world experience in your own community.
As an addition to your comment about families, I know a family that has picked their own little place where they do stream monitoring. And that's just something they go out several times over the summer as a family. And do. And it's not terribly hard, but it's a family thing, and it does impress the importance of scientific measurement.
Exactly.
For those of you just joining us, our topic is bats today on the morning show, in case you couldn't tell by now. And we have three guests in the studios. Nan Calvert, of course, is always here for these environmental programs once a month. And with her two guests, two good friends who are citizen bat monitors under the auspices of the DNR, Melissa Warner and Jan Carter, who some of you listening perhaps already know from some of the other work which they do in the community. Let's talk for a moment about, in general, the bat population in this part of the state. I mean, just how many different kinds of bats are we talking about? And how does one even sort of keep track of the variety? Or is that not part of what you guys are doing as monitors?
They do want to know exactly which kinds are where in the state. And what we have been, what Paul White in the DNR tells me is that although there are 7 bat species known to be in Wisconsin, we usually see the big browns and the reds. We sometimes see the hoary bat and the silver-haired bat. We often, periodically in the summer, see little browns, and very, very occasionally we'll see the eastern pipistrelle. We never see here the northern long-eared. That's elsewhere in the state. But what that enabled them to decide is, okay, the threatened species are not as common in our area of the state. So they've been able to put their serious efforts elsewhere. But he did tell me that our group has completed 222 surveys over 6 years. And so they've been able to really get a really good population. They're little snapshots, but they're snapshots from the same place over 5 or 6 years so that they really get a good picture.
Hmm. Jan Carter, describe what a typical outing is like when you are engaged in this bat monitoring process. And are you doing it all by yourself or with a couple of partners? How logistically typically is it done?
We generally go out in pairs, and each of us, each pair is assigned to a certain area. Could be a park, could be a golf course, and we pretty much keep to the same route each time, so we're in the same area so that it can be easily compared to from one visit to another. We go out once a month, and we go out with our little device and make sure it connects to the satellites, wait for the GPS connection to occur, and then we hang around a little bit until sunset, or we go at sunset, and we start the walk, the monitoring, 1 half hour after sunset, and we walk for 1 hour without retracing our steps. So we have a loop. And we walk at a moderate pace through woods or meadows or wherever we are in the park area. And it's not a strenuous walk by any means, but we just pace ourselves. And while you're walking, you keep an eye on your monitor, and it makes a noise, as Melissa said. It translates the bat's sonar sound into a sound that people can hear, and that alerts you to press the GPS button to mark that spot. So as you're walking, you're constantly being aware of what's happening on your little screen and the noise that it's making. And it, when it makes this scritch, scritch, scritch noise, you press the button, and that's a hit.
So on a typical excursion, 1 hour long, how often does that happen, that you hear that scritch, 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 and the presence of a bat is detected?
It varies quite a bit. It often it will be in one part of the walk or the park, and it'll happen pretty often, every couple minutes or so, and then you might walk for 10, 15 minutes and not have any hits. This may be because you're near a roadway or closer to civilization or something, somewhere where the bats aren't. We do not go out if it's pouring rain. We don't go out if it's under 50 degrees Fahrenheit because the bats just aren't out there then.
Oh, okay. But it has nothing to do with your own hardiness.
No, not really.
The bats are fussy. Okay.
Because most of these or many of these walks are in local parks, the first time I went out with my partner on our own after training with Jay Warner, the police came by and mentioned to us that we were in the park after hours because the park closes at sunset unless you have a camping permit in Sanders Park. So we enthusiastically showed them what we were doing, showed them our monitoring equipment, and told them why this was important and that it was under the auspices of the DNR. And they were very kind and said, oh, that's really interesting, but we do have to tell you that you are in the park after hours. But we won't be back until after midnight, so continue your walk. But after that, we did go to the county park department, because Sanders Park is a county park in Racine County, and receive permission to be in the park after hours for the purposes of bat monitoring. They wrote us a very nice email saying that this is appropriate and we have permission, and they copied all the local law enforcement officers who might be patrolling the park. So I actually felt happy about that, that they were on board with this, and also I felt good that they do patrol the parks and keep an eye on who's out there wandering around.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And why Sanders Park? Was that a place you chose? It was conveniently located for you or any?
No, I'm not sure if anyone had been doing that before, Melissa, or that was a new park.
It was a new park, and it was one that we saw that we really needed. It was in a different location. We know it's pretty much undisturbed, a certain kind of older woodlands, and we really needed to know what was going on there. Mm. And there are lots of bats, so we're really glad that you and Mary do that.
So what are the other locations that are monitored in this program around here?
Yes, we do the Pike River, but the headwaters up in Mount Pleasant. We do Shoup Park in Wind Point. We do Riverbend Nature Center and Armstrong right across the park from that. Racine Lakefront, Petrifying Springs, Pritchard Park, Elmwood Park. We have a route in Bristol and a route in Salem. And some of the places where we would have thought we had a lot of bats, we haven't had so many. Not so many this past two summers at Riverbend, which is full of trees and water and insects. No insecticide, no spraying. And not so many at Armstrong right across the river. So this is a puzzle. We don't understand why. And not nearly as many along the lakefront. And Paul has noticed that. They've been very interested in the bat activity along the lakefront because of the possibility of offshore wind turbines. And what they think is because it's such a large lake, the wind speeds are just a little higher. The fetch is longer. And bats do fly, but they're not that strong a flyer, and they'd rather go where they don't have to fight the winds. Or it may be that the winds keep the insect population down, and why would they be there if the insects aren't there? What he would like, and maybe one of your listeners could help us out with this, is a boat run to do a section of the lakefront about a half mile from shore and see if there's any activity out in the lake.
That might tell us something further about why the bats are behaving as they are and why they're going where they're going.
Yeah. But we've noticed at Shoup Park, when we do the part of Shoup along the lake, few bats. When we do the part of Shoup that is the golf course, sometimes there are many bats.
Interesting. Nan, we should make sure that our listeners remember your connection to bats with Sino and the barn and that whole story, which you haven't told them. Wasn't that at Sino?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we had a sizable colony, a nursery colony of bats in the roof of the old barn. And it was getting to be somewhat of a problem because the amount of guano. And, of course, we use that for public presentations, and increasingly so. And so
Used the barn.
Yes, exactly.
Not the guano,
rather. But, of course, we could have sold it. It makes great fertilizer. But and also we needed a new roof. So we started working with Professor Deanna Burns from Carthage College to, one, establish, you know, what kind of a colony we had, what size was it, and then determine was there good habitat so that we could very safely, start the re-roofing project without impacting the colony, especially so because of white nose syndrome. We didn't want to lose any. And so it was just a fascinating period of time wherein Dr. Burns and some of her students would come, and I got to be there too, and we would just sit outside and determine where the bats were entering and exiting, count them. There was a very fancy bat monitor that they actually trusted me enough to hold and use. And interestingly enough, and I don't know if Melissa's monitor does this, but all bats' calls produce a different shape on the sonogram, on the readout. So you can tell fairly specifically what species of bats they are, which was just fascinating. And so, you know, based on the data we collected from there and knowing the life cycle of the bats, we were able to put on a new roof pretty easily. Now, you have to remember that bats are very small mammals comparatively, and they're in a sense, thigmotactic. In other words, they need to be up against something. Mm. They like to be very warm so they can get in and out of very tiny places. And so there were at least a couple of very tiny places left over after the roof was put on. And we worked with a specialist who was able to locate where those places were and begin sealing those up at the appropriate time of year so that the bats don't reenter. At the same time, we had a number of wonderful volunteers who built the most amazing bat boxes for us based on the current standards of what's most effective, and we put those up very near where the bats were entering and exiting. Mm. Also, at the same time, we were able to determine that directly across the street from us, Camp Otakota had a very large population of bats that they didn't know about. And sort of amusing, they had put up a big bat house on the front of one of their buildings, but there were absolutely no bats in there. But if you looked up just above the top of the bat house, there was a very tiny hole in the siding, and the bats were going in and out of there. And there was a very large colony, large enough to say, you know, we can't use this until we do something about it because the accumulation of guano. So we have thriving bat populations on Highway P, and I would love to invite Sierra Club to start coming out and help us figure out, you know, now where exactly are our bats going? If they're not taking up residence in our bat houses, where are they, and what can we do to encourage them to live there? Because we need them there. They eat insects, and that's what we want them to do. I just want to remind everybody, you know, it's just after Halloween where we sort of make bats a comical and frightening character. None of our bats suck blood here in Wisconsin. They eat insects, and we want them to be their very beneficial flying mammal for us. So
you mentioned bat houses, and it is one of the things people can do to build an appropriate bat house. Make sure you're using good directions, and the DNR has several on their website. And I did learn that one of the reasons the inside needs to be rough is for the babies to hang on while mom and dad are out eating. The babies are left behind, and they have to have something they can hold on to well, because their mom is not there to hang on to.
Okay, so so there needs to be a certain rough texture to the walls.
Yes.
Gives them grip, a place
to grip. And particularly horizontally, not vertically.
Interesting.
But it still is very hard to get bats to use the bat house. They're very particular, and we don't have a magic answer. Some people think if you put guano around the bat house, it will attract bats. I don't have an answer. Do you have any idea what would encourage bats to use the bat house?
I think if you are in the process of having a colony safely and humanely removed and then preventing them from entering into where they were before, it's really important to put your bat houses very near the entrance and exit.
Of where they want to go.
Of where they want to go. The problem is, living in the roof of the barn was sort of a palace for the bats. It was very, very warm. It was very high up, so predators couldn't get to them. They're completely concealed. And so recreating that is very difficult. They had an enormous amount of square footage to nest and rest and feed and breed. And so it's difficult. But we followed very strict guidelines about bat house building. And in fact, two of the houses we built, based on some research done, they're very, very long and wide, but they're very narrow, and we mounted them back to back because sometimes the bats like to roost between the bat houses instead of not necessarily in. But, you know, the temperature gradient is different. So even though they like it very, very warm, you know, sometimes they need a little bit of air conditioning there. One really important thing to do is stop spraying pesticides. Bats eat insects. That's what they're supposed to do. And if we continue minimizing their food source, we're not going to have bats. And, of course, pesticides have far-ranging implications anyway. When you spray a pesticide, it's nonspecific, so you're killing all kinds of things.
And not just the pest.
Not just the real or perceived pest.
Right.
And, of course, you know, we know that if we're going to have native insects for our native bats, we need native things for the insects to eat, like native plants. So, again, it's systems thinking. It's all connected. So plant native plants. Stop killing off our native insects so that our bats and frogs and toads and birds and other insect eaters will have something to eat.
Hmm. One thing I don't think we've clarified yet, Jan, how often does this happen? You mentioned that it's just after sunset, so depending on what time of year we're talking about, that determines the time of day or time of evening that you're out there. How often does this happen, and how do you kind of choose the actual date that you do that, or is that sort of specified by the DNR of when you need to be out there? I mean, is it spread throughout the calendar year, for instance?
It's during the summer, basically from about May until September, and we each group or pair goes out about once a month, and so we spend one evening a month, roughly 3 to 4 or 5 weeks apart. It's not absolutely on a certain day. Again, it depends on the weather. It depends on people's schedules. Depends on whether we can get the bat monitoring equipment that night, because we only have one piece of equipment, so only one group can go out on any one night.
Gotcha.
So the Warners coordinate the equipment with us, and we figure out who can take it on what night and then get it back to them, and there's couple sets of batteries that have to be charged up every single time. And so it's kind of a complicated logistics matter to keep this equipment running and get it back and forth to people. But once a month per group that's monitoring.
Yeah, we send the nagging emails. You know, who's going to take the equipment this week? Good weather this week. Who can go out?
Right.
So.
But what we're talking about is actually quite a modest time commitment then. I mean, if you're doing this, let's say, four times through the course of the late spring, summer, into the early autumn, that's about 4 hours of your time, essentially, then, that you're devoting to this important cause.
Yeah, a little more with travel and
sure.
Set up. And we try to set up usually, I do at least, before sunset while it's still light out and you have time to make sure you get the GPS connection. Sometimes you have to, with any computer, turn it all off and then start it up again.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a connection. Or you might have to walk around a little bit to get into a clearing to make the satellite connection. But it's not a difficult thing to do, but it is a commitment, and you know, people have families or meetings in the evening or things, so you have to work around people's schedules that way.
Sure.
One of the benefits, though, Greg, is walking at night in the woods in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And other people aren't around. There are no ATVs, and it's not noisy. And it can be very magical if the moon's up or the stars are out or It's a lovely experience, although
right,
it may be a bit frantic to get there and to be ready at the right time. And is your GPS going to connect this time? But once we start walking, it's really quite magical.
Yeah, calm and beautiful. And of course, the park, technically speaking, is closed, so you probably have the park pretty much to yourself then.
Often.
Except for the bats.
Sanders Park is pitch dark at night.
Wow.
It is a paved route that we walk, although we veer off the paved road a little bit into the parking areas and clearings. And we usually have flashlights or headlamps to help light the way, because it's dark out there.
Huh.
And except for the little area in Sanders Park that is a campground, we don't see any people out there at all.
Interesting.
Although when we get to the campground, it's interesting that oftentimes there are people still outdoors sitting around the campfire, and we'll greet them, and they'll say, what are you guys doing?
Yeah,
and
right.
So we'll go over and show the families and the kids what we're doing. And
spread the good word.
Spread the word. They're very interested in it.
Very good. Melissa, the equipment that you actually brought with you, the monitoring device from the DNR, you were saying that it delineates different kinds of bat calls or songs or whatever we call the noise that bats make.
Yeah, as Nan mentioned, each kind of bat makes a characteristic trace, picture. And I'm not good at identifying them quickly enough. But they send us a map. And I can't hold it up close to the microphone.
Right.
But you can see it's like a Google map, except overlaid on that is this yellow line, which is the route. And I can see little green dots, which means that we had little brown bats, and brown dots, which are the big brown bats. bats and some blue ones. And this route, they had some hoary bats show up so that we get the information back and it interprets the picture into the kind of bat it was.
I'm trying to remember, with this device, are you hearing something also? I mean, like, does it actually amplify the sound of the bats?
Well, it translates it to a lower frequency.
Okay.
And then you can hear it.
So you are, in a sense, actually hearing the sound of the bats. I mean,
yes.
Sounds that you otherwise would not be able to hear.
True.
They're so sensitive that even insect calls of the tiniest insect that normally you might not even hear end up sounding really loud.
Ah.
And it's really amazing.
Wow.
It's an amazing, and they're small. I mean, I know you can't see it, those of you who are listening, but it's about the size of
smaller
than a bread box.
Right.
Smaller than a shoebox.
A transistor radio.
Right.
For those of us who remember what transistor radios are.
Or it looks a little bit like the way Polaroid cameras used to look when they would spit out the picture right away. Polaroid Instamatic camera. It's roughly about that size. So it's a modest size instrument, but does some amazing things,
exactly.
Of course. We're talking today with Melissa Warner, Jan Carter, and, of course, Nan Calvert about bats on this monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. One of the reasons there is this urgent now interest in bats is because of this fungal disease that is affecting so much of the population. And what is that called again?
It's called white nose syndrome.
White nose syndrome. I happen to have audio from a previous visit from Nan Calvert with the aforementioned Dr. Deanna Burns, who is a biology professor at Carthage College. And I thought it would be interesting to hear just a portion of this conversation in which she talks about this particular disease among the population and where it originated and so on. We'll just listen to a little bit of this. Again, this is Dr. Deanna Burns on a previous morning show talking about bats.
Fungal disease, that's fairly recent. It was first found in, well, its first incidence actually probably was in the winter of 2006-2007, identified in upstate New York at Howe Cavern, which is a commercial cave. And people identified this as a problem because bats were acting funny through the winter when they should have been hibernating through the winter. They were coming out of hibernation early when there was still snow on the ground, when there was not any insects available, emaciated, looking for food and not finding any, and dying in very large numbers.
Wow.
Since then, this disease has been spreading winter by winter, and just this last spring, in March and April, our Department of Natural Resources did identify some areas in Wisconsin where they have confirmed that white nose syndrome has now reached Wisconsin. So in Grant County, in the very southwestern corner of the state, as well as just over the border in Upper Michigan, the Michigan DNR has identified some hibernacula where they have identified white nose syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very devastating disease. Where it first started in upstate New York, some of those populations are gone, completely gone. Average 80% mortality rate for those populations that hibernate.
Wow.
So we will soon find out what that means to not have our bats. Like I said before, the food web is a very finely tuned network. But bats are not the only things that eat insects, but they do eat quite a few insects. So it'll be interesting to see. I hope, you know, I hope we'll still think that it's interesting and not just completely devastating.
Mm.
That insect populations will react somehow, and other predators of insects, those populations will react somehow as well.
Right. Do we understand what's going on with this strange disease? I mean, do we know? I mean, first of all, literally, does their snout become white?
Yeah, right. So that's why it was named, right? So
mm-hmm.
It was identified. It's a fungus. It's a very interesting fungus. It's a soil fungus that somehow has been able to infect the skin of the bats. So when, but as a fungus goes, you might know that sometimes you don't see the fungus at all, right? There are a lot of mycelia that are in the soil or whatever, and then the fruiting body is the mushroom. Mm-hmm. So when we see a bat that has a white nose or white powdery stuff on its skin, that's the fruiting body. So it might have an infection. At other times, we just don't see it. But it attacks them in the hibernacula where it's that particular temperature, particular humidity. It's a cold-loving fungus, so it does really well there. When the bats are hibernating, they lower their metabolic rate, and so they're not as able to fight off an infection. But it causes them to try to fight off the infection, which then causes them to use up their fat reserves, and then they can't make it all the way through the winter through hibernating. So they're burning up their reserves too quickly, and then they're thirsty and hungry, and there's nothing for them to eat.
I wondered what it was that, in a sense, awakened them from hibernation.
Yeah. The actual physiological mechanism is not really clear, but we know that's the pattern, that they bats normally, when they're hibernating, will arouse periodically and get a drink or to move around. But those that are infected, we do have data now to show that they arouse more frequently than a bat that's not infected.
Wow. Dr. Deanna Burns from Carthage College, it's from a previous visit to the morning show, kind of explaining some of the physiological actions that are behind this really terrible disease that is having such a devastating effect on bat populations around the country.
And devastating means nearly 6 million bats have died since it was first discovered. That's an enormous amount of bats. When she mentioned Howe Cave, there are almost no bats left in it. So the difficulty has been, you know, multifold. It's a devastating disease for the bat population because it's almost always fatal. It's spread really, really quickly, so quickly that researchers, biologists, conservationists, zoologists, you know, just had no time to try and figure out how can you possibly do anything about this. And bat caves are very popular tourist sites. People love to see bats. So when tourists are tramping around in there, as we do because we want to see things, that fungus then can perceivably get on your shoes and you're taking it everywhere, thus hastening the spread of the disease. But I want to tell you something that I just recently learned about. And if you have your paper and pencil ready, the Nature Conservancy has a blog called Cool Green Science. And in May of this year, an author by the name of Matt Miller produced an article that is just giving the very hint of a glimmer of hope in combating this horrible disease. And it, like so many things in science, it came about purely by luck. So there was a researcher who was studying how to preserve tropical fruit that we bring over to this country that very quickly ripens. So how do you slow that ripening process? And he realized that there is a bacterium that produced a VOC, a volatile organic compound, that had a significant impact on slowing the ripening of bananas because it impacted the life cycle of a fungus that caused the ripening. So he knew about this fungus, this white nose syndrome, and he thought, I wonder if this has any effect. So all these smart people, all the right people came together, and they started in a very controlled experiment in the laboratory, taking bats with white nose syndrome, exposing them to the VOC emitted by this bacterium, and wouldn't you know, they recovered.
Wow.
And those bats were then re-released and tagged, of course, so they could study them. And they made it through the winter.
Wow.
So how does that translate into real world practice? We don't. We meaning you know, don't know. It was in a very controlled, very small population, but it was highly successful.
Right.
So
how do we apply that out in the environment?
If you release this bacterium into a bat cave, what other effect is it having on the ecology of the cave floor? Because that's a whole nother ecology that no doubt has something to do with the bats and the other cave-dwelling species.
Right. So they need to make sure doing that wouldn't cause other problems, even more serious problems, although it's hard to imagine a more serious problem than this disease affecting the bats.
And what people need to understand is that there isn't a lot of there's not a lot of money being funded to this, even though this is an essential thing that we do, because if the entirety of our bat population crashes, the insect-eating bats, it will have an effect on everything we do, from agriculture to gardening to just being outside and enjoying the great outdoors.
And so,
we need to talk to our legislators and all of those other kinds of people who could have the power to funnel some money into these kinds of research projects.
Right. So perhaps this answer can really become an answer that works out in the world, out in the field.
Exactly. Right.
Related to that, I could mention, in addition to the bat monitoring, if you would like to do that, there's also bat roost monitoring. So if you know a place that has bats, there are some monitoring activities you can do with those. But the third way you could support it is that this project is supported through the National Resources Foundation. It's not funded directly through the DNR budget, which right now, given their cuts, is probably a good thing. But if you would like to support bats, the National Resources Foundation would appreciate any monetary donation you might like to make.
Right.
As well as Bat Conservation International, they are involved with the research on this particular glimmer of hope, shall we say.
That's very good to hear. Melissa, do you still need more bat monitors, or do you have, by and large, all the people that you need at the moment?
There are wonderful other places that we could monitor.
Like Sino.
Like Sino would be terrific. And even in the western part of Racine County, we don't have anyone there. The difficulty is time to travel back and forth. As Jan mentioned, we have only one set of equipment. And we do have people who jobs change and they move. So we've lost a monitor we won't have next year. We lost one this year because she'd had knee surgery. And walking a solid hour, even on a good paved road, was just more than she could manage right now. So, yes, we'd love some more volunteers.
And what should people do if they are interested?
Probably an email at melissa.warner, that's WARNER, 3, numeral 3, at sbcglobal.net.
Say that one more time.
melissa.warner3 at sbcglobal.net.
Very good. And we should maybe mention also, although briefly, I'm afraid, that there are other citizen science opportunities that are available. Why don't you just run down a quick list?
There's a loon watch. The deer hunters have their own wildlife surveys that they're asked to complete when they're out hunting. Lakes, stream water quality, ephemeral ponds, how they do in the springtime with hatching toads and frogs and salamanders, for instance. Prairie groups, Great Lakes marshes, carnivore tracking. There's just anything that you might like to do outside. Somebody's probably studying it and you can help. And I would go to DNR, Citizen Science, or monitoring, poke around the website. They're probably not all listed in just one place.
Very good. Melissa Warner and Jan Carter are two of the bat monitors here in southeastern Wisconsin, and we commend you for your participation in this really important program, and Melissa, of course, especially in helping to coordinate it. And we hope people will seek out this opportunity if it intrigues them, and otherwise find other ways to learn more about these beautiful and important creatures that live among us. Nan Calvert, let's finish out with some calendar events.
I'm going to throw it over to Melissa to do the Sierra Club one, and then I'll take over.
Okay.
Two events from Sierra. One is tonight, the film Merchants of Doubt, about the concerted and planned effort to undermine scientific research from tobacco to climate change. Tonight at the Racine Building, Lake Avenue in Racine at 6:30. And next Thursday, how the food choices, your food choices, affect the environment. We often talk about nutrition, we talk about local farming, but what is the impact on the environment of these food choices? And that will be right here in this very building where we are now, at the Biosciences Building downstairs on the Racine Gateway campus. Jamie Furshinger from the Urban Ecology Center will be the speaker.
Great. So on the Kenosha campus of Gateway. Very good.
All right. If you don't have anything to do tomorrow, which is Friday the 13th, you should be going to Hoy Audubon's Owl Prowl at Richard Bong State Recreational Area. Starts at 7 p.m. Dress for the weather and, bring binoculars, I suppose, if you have them. And you'll have a really wonderful time listening. And I'm sure Rick Fair will have his owl calls there so that you can hoot for owls. December 5th, Hawthorne Hollow is having their holiday boutique from 9 until 3 p.m. Great gifts to support a wonderful place. All the proceeds go to Hawthorne Hollow. River Bend, December 12th, 9 until noon, the Gifts of Nature program. Kids can create handmade gifts to share during this entire program. Registration is required, and the fee is all materials included, $25 for members, $30 for non-members. And Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center this Saturday, which is November 14th, 9:30 in the morning, they're having an origami mobile workshop. You get to create a wonderful mobile for your own pleasure, $15 per person, and please call to register.
Very good.
Thank you.
Nan Calverts, thank you for organizing this very interesting morning show today, and we look forward to seeing you in December.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thanks also for connecting it to the segment we did with Dr. Burns.
Wasn't that fun to hear
it
from her again?
It was. Very cool.
Absolutely. Nan Calvert, thank you again for your help with the
You're
morning
welcome.
Show. Tomorrow on the morning show, British science writer Tom Jackson, who has written a very interesting book called The Brain, which is actually, more than anything, a history of neuroscience. Dating all the way back, believe it or not, to prehistoric man. It's a fascinating book, and we'll talk about it on tomorrow's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. We are under a wind advisory until 6 p.m. Winds are expected to become much more intense into the late morning and afternoon hours, up to 35 miles per hour and perhaps higher gusts, and a 40% chance of additional light rain. A high today of 49 degrees. Overnight, very windy conditions and a low of 35 degrees. Cloudy and windy again tomorrow, perhaps with some snow showers in the morning. A high of just 46. It will be sunny both Saturday and Sunday. Saturday, a high of 53. Sunday, a high of 59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,